Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If there is one thing that plays a role in practically all of our national elections, it is the economy. The Biden administration will tell you the economy is roaring. They take credit for bringing us from the doldrums of the pandemic to a time of nearly full employment and rising wages. The Trump team talks about out-of-control inflation and amplifies many citizen complaints about the unaffordable cost of living. Both have elements of truth. And though economic indicators tell experts the U.S. economy is the envy of the world, if buying groceries empties your checking account, or if you can't afford to buy a home for your growing family because of high home prices or high interest rates, then your personal economy isn't doing so well. What metrics to use? How do we gauge where the economy really is, where it's really heading? And how do we answer the million-dollar question, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? On this Politics Monday, we get into that with Vikram Kumar. He is professor of economics at Davidson College. Bailey Lipschultz is senior reporter with the U.S. equities team at Bloomberg News. And Mary Ramsey is joining us. She's local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning to you all. Welcome. It's radio, so you got to speak. We'll move on. Vikram, I'm going to start with you. How would you describe the overall economy, the economic conditions that real people are experiencing right now?
So, you know, there are different perspectives, but overall, if you look at the economy, the U.S. economy has navigated an environment of many challenges. But it is of moderate growth, easing inflation, and a cooling labor market is where we are at right now. But considerable uncertainties also exist at this point. But broadly speaking, the economy has shown a mix of resilience and moderation over the last few quarters, I would say. It also reflects a lot of the complex dynamics of the COVID era that seem to be resolving itself. There have been some structural changes, during COVID that were not as well understood and probably are being better understood now. And it seems that the economy is moving into a little bit better recognizable, pattern. But there are uncertainties out there, and that's what's being reflected in the market, market changes right now. That's what the Fed has been grappling with. The data that has come in, recently is a mixed bag. The unemployment rate has ticked up to 4.3%, which is higher than it has been for quite a long time. That has led to a considerable amount of angst in the markets.
Have had a bad inflationary period that we've gone through, and a lot of people are angry about that, and they're still experiencing that, although it is subsiding a little bit. It has not yet returned to pre-pandemic levels. And I want to know from you, Vikram, if a lot of the anger over this is because there are a lot of people who never experienced any significant inflation in their adult lives. So this was a whole new phenomenon for them.
Absolutely. I think that, only the baby boomers, when they were younger, experienced, a bad bout of inflation. But otherwise, we have been inflation-free for a long period of time, which is actually a good testament to, the policy-making skills and understanding of the economy. But the COVID period was very disruptive, and I think that the policy stances that were taken were probably, it didn't work out as well as it should have. So I think that there are lessons to be learned.
So, Bailey, there were disruptions because of the pandemic, and nobody was to blame for that. It just happened. We had to shut down the economy. Businesses closed. People sequestered at home, et cetera, et cetera. We all know what happened. And the supply chain was disrupted. And when supply cannot meet demand, prices rise. But all of those problems are long in our past, and yet inflation has lingered. Is that because businesses are trying to make up for what they lost during the pandemic? Is it because once prices rise, they really don't come down to the point they were before? What's really the cause for this lingering inflation?
It really depends which industries you're pointing to, and I'm sure Vikram would be better positioned to speak to some of the underlying dynamics. But we saw companies like PepsiCo and Coca-Cola hiking prices simply because they could pass along costs and they could expand their profit margins and be able to assume that consumers would be willing to pay up. We saw that play out. That isn't playing out as much right now. And when you look at what the Fed uses really as their benchmark gauge for what inflation is, they actually strip out food and energy. So the cost at the pump and the cost at the grocery store are actually removed from their conversation. And it's
But
heavily skewed towards.
isn't that where the average person feels it the most?
Exactly. And that's the big concern and kind of debate when you look at Federal Reserve policy, is it's so heavily skewed towards housing costs. So if rent is very expensive and getting more expensive, that overwhelmingly can shift some of those costs. Similar to car insurance is another thing. And the cost of used car purchases during the pandemic and in the wake of that was another driver of inflation. So to your point, the underlying average American is really seeing inflation hitting out at areas that, for the most part, the Fed isn't ignoring, but isn't factoring as heavily into their equation on where they view where interest rates could be. When you look at prices, it's hard to see or kind of make an argument if you're a CEO that maybe we should pare back some of those costs. We are seeing the likes of a McDonald's pushing their $5 value menu. We're seeing Target cutting prices on a number of goods. But the argument is that once inflation is kind of into the system, it's harder to push for deflation without something heavily breaking.
And are companies like McDonald's offering these value meals strictly because they're seeing a decline in consumer willingness to buy those products? I know I read a whole thing about the Walt Disney theme parks are having trouble because they've raised their prices and attendance is down. Well, what do you know? So is that part of the reason why these companies are now offering these deals?
That's certainly a part of it. And when you look at fast casual dining trends, you see kind of this bifurcation where people who can afford to go to something like a Sweetgreen and pay $18 for a salad here in New York, they're more than happy and able to do that. But your average consumer is peeling back some of that more discretionary spending. And maybe a McDonald's value meal is more within the budget of someone who's maybe living paycheck to paycheck, as opposed to some of the higher prices that we've seen at pretty much pick any fast casual or regular restaurant.
So, Vikram, prices are up, and they've been up for quite a while, although we are told that they are coming down a little bit. Let's just say that the prices are rising more slowly than they have been. They're not really necessarily down. And that is not the same as deflation. And despite the fact that I would like to see, when I go to the grocery store, a tomato for a lot less money than I'm paying for it right now, we don't want to see deflation. Am I right about that? And if so, why? Why don't we want to see deflation?
Well, before I answer the question, I just want to add to Bailey's point. The Atlanta Fed tracks something called the sticky price inflation. So the sticky price is basically prices that change very slowly, but they change a lot when they do, and they don't come down. And the sticky price inflation rate, according to the Atlanta Fed, is at 4.2%. So that is partly what has been, keeping the rate of inflation from declining, significantly. It's lingering, as you said, because of that sticky price element in the commodities and services. But more to your point, we don't like to see deflation because there are a lot of contracts that businesses have that are fixed in nominal terms. So most of the wages that are paid out, are basically fixed in dollar terms, and if prices decline, then it puts firms at a in a bad situation because the revenue stream becomes smaller and they get into a loss-making situation that can be very contractionary, and it can be bad for the economy as a whole, for the workers, And so the general idea has been that, a moderate pace of inflation, which the Fed has interpreted at about 2% for its particular index that it follows, is something good, like an inflation rate that people don't really think about. Inflation is a good rate of inflation to have in the economy.
Mary Ramsey's with us. She's the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. So she deals with politicians, she deals with government, she deals with voters. And when North Carolinians talk about the economy and concerns over inflation, Mary, I'm assuming that they're really talking about what they're paying for food in the grocery store, what they're paying for gas at the gas station, maybe what they're paying for food in restaurants, which seems to be a lot higher, almost doubly what it used to be down here. And I suppose to a certain degree, the cost of housing. Are they also talking about what they're experiencing in the stock market with their 401ks?
Not as much that I've heard. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. I think, the everyday goods like groceries and gas, and also especially in Charlotte, it's still a lot of talk about housing affordability, whether that's rental rates or the ability to actually buy a home, especially when you get into slightly younger demographics. I think that's still a point of major concern. And if we want to get into the weeds of, federal policy and things that the presidential election are connected to, also student loan debt is another economic issue that I hear about a lot more, frankly, than issues with the stock market.
Yeah. But I read in your paper this morning that rents in Charlotte are on the decline. And I guess that's a supply and demand thing. We have a glut of apartments, and suddenly over the last year, rents have been declining. How significant has that been? Do you know?
So that is something that's been reported. It's something that came up, for example, last week, talking about the Brooklyn Village project. The developers of that saying that lower rents present a challenge to them in redeveloping that property. That being said, as a renter in Charlotte who spends a lot of time talking to other renters in Charlotte, both socially and for work, I don't know necessarily that the average renter in Charlotte is feeling that yet,
Okay.
frankly.
Gerald Ford, Bailey. Gerald Ford lost to Jimmy Carter largely because of rampant inflation and his failed Whip Inflation Now program. I used to have a whip button that we would wear to naught. Is inflation something that presidents really can control or even influence? Or is that really up to economic factors beyond their control and the Fed, which is also semi beyond their control?
I think the majority of the factors, especially if you talk to investors and people on Wall Street, it's for the most part out of their control. They can implement policies that do have impacts. So if you slap tariffs on and kind of get into a trade war, that can impact inflation, similar to if you kind of push for different general tax benefits for companies. In theory, that would also impact it. But I would say most likely, for the majority of kind of history that I've tracked, at least, a lot of it really is, for the most part, out of their hands. But again, they can impact and kind of push things in certain directions that can therefore kind of cause a domino effect.
So is it silly for presidents and presidential candidates to take credit for the good economy and for people to blame presidents for a bad economy?
I'm not a political reporter, but I will say it, human nature would be you would point out things that benefit you and retract things that don't kind of boost your image.
And Mary, I have about 30 seconds in this segment, but as you talk to people out there on in town, is inflation top of mind? Is that the issue they talk about when they think about going to the polls in November?
I don't know that it's the number one driving issue, but I think it is an issue. I think whether it's reality or perception, people do feel like things are very expensive right now and getting more expensive. And I don't know, I don't know that it's number one as they head to the polls, but I think it's definitely on their mind.
Mary Ramsey with the Charlotte Observer, Bailey Lipschultz with Bloomberg News, and Vikram Kumar of Davidson College. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the election and the economy and the intersection thereof with Vikram Kumar. He is a professor of economics at Davidson College. Bailey Lipschultz is a senior reporter with the U.S. Equities team at Bloomberg News. And Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. The cost of living here in Charlotte and around the country is higher than it was prior to the pandemic. The housing market is tight. It has been for a very long time. And I think it was probably fairly tight and expensive prior to the pandemic. But of course, a lot of people aren't selling their homes, which means that younger people can't move up. And a lot of people aren't selling their homes because interest rates are so high and they're at 2% or something like that. And they don't want to move into a new home where the interest rates are 8%. Groceries and dining out are more expensive. So Mary, do voters blame President Biden for this?
I think it depends on who you ask. I think, you know, we live in such polarized times, and particularly in a media landscape where so many people are getting their information from sources that are lean politically one way or another. I think, you know, if you ask Republican voters or people who lean Republican, they do have a little bit more economic concern and they do point the blame at the Biden administration. I think if you talk to Democrats or people who lean more Democratic, they tend to be more open to the Biden now Harris campaign's message of look at the low unemployment rates, look at the direction wages are moving. So I think it really depends on sort of where people fall on the political spectrum. That being said, there are people in the middle who don't necessarily have allegiance to either party. Those voters are going to be critical in this election. And I think both campaigns are going to be, especially in the next few weeks, really gearing up their economic messages to try and win over those undecided voters.
Vikram, Donald Trump says he had the greatest economy the world has ever known. He points to low to non-existent inflation, which was there prior to his arrival at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He points to a rising stock market. And then COVID arrived, the shutdown began, the supply chain was disrupted, and Joe Biden inherited all of that and the fallout from all of that. But he says he has helped to rebuild an economy that is now unrivaled in the world, that is the envy of the world. Which one of them is right?
Well, they're both right in their own ways and probably not as right as they would like us to think. So it is undoubtedly the case that by at least most of the metrics that economists might look at, the Trump economy was very strong. The unemployment rate was at a historically low level, I think matched only since 1969. Incomes were very, you know, moving forward very strongly. But there were big tax cuts and that created a lot of national debt load. And I think that that is something that the other party doesn't really talk about very much because they're also complicit in increasing the national debt. But it is also true that the economy recovered very, very smartly after COVID, which, you know, was the current administration's, during the current administration. And but it can be argued that too much stimulus was put in the economy, both from the point of view of fiscal policy in terms of like government spending and also like the monetary policy side was a little bit too permissive.
And a lot of people, a lot of experts, a lot of economists predicted that we would be in a recession, a bad recession by now or even a year ago. And we so far have not been in a recession. And yesterday, Bailey, Brian Moynihan, who's the CEO of the Bank of America, was on Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan. And he says they no longer see a recession in our future, but he does see two interest cuts by the Fed in our future. Other big bankers predicted earlier this year that there would be interest cuts and they were interest rate cuts and they were wrong. Could he be right? What's the impact of that on stocks and the business world? And if he sees that, doesn't Jamie Dimon see that and other big movers and shakers in the business world?
We've been talking about the next interest rate cut and the next recession for the better part of a year and a half. I think when you look at some of the commentary from the Federal Reserve recently, the expectation is to pencil in at least 25 basis points, so 0.25% interest rate cut in September when they meet. Different kind of markets are varying in whether that'll be 25 basis points or what we would call a jumbo rate cut, which is 50 basis points or 0.5%, and kind of where it can go from there. So the expectation for quite some time at this point has been interest rates will go down. It's just a question of when and how quickly. The big debate, though, has long been if you cut too quickly, how does that impact the market and how does that impact kind of an ability for kind of business to continue operating, and how predicated are companies operating that there will be interest rate cuts, and how that will actually cause a ripple effect, if you will, through the economy and the underlying market.
And yesterday, Vikram, Brian Moynihan credited the Biden administration for shepherding us through this and for helping us to avoid a recession. Democrats have long complained that the Biden administration doesn't get enough credit for how they have what they call the greatest economic recovery in history. Is it the greatest economic recovery in history?
It is a very, very strong recovery. After COVID, when the economy was in the tank, I think the recovery was what we call a V-shaped recovery. So it fell into the basement very quickly, but it came out very quickly. It was a very, very good recovery, no doubt about that. I think that the reason people have a little bit, you know, not feeling very happy about it is partly because of inflation, or mainly because of inflation, and inflation hits a lot of people who are on fixed income. It hits people more who are low income because they don't have much discretionary spending, so they don't have the freedom to, you know, not buy things, you know, and most people are not in the 99% of the people are not in the top 1%. Or, you know, 80% of the people are not in the top 20%. And so a lot of people, as you had said earlier at the top of the program, when they go to the grocery store or go to the gas station, which people do every week, they feel the sting of that inflation. So even though the economy in macroeconomic terms has done really very well, there have been redistributional effects. I mean, interest rates have gone up, and that has had a big impact on the ability, particularly of first-time home buyers, and people getting into, you know, sort of buying into the American dream of home ownership, that has stalled. So I think that those are elements that balance out the, you know, wonderful sort of recovery that did in fact happen.
Bailey, the stock market is not the economy, but I'm sure that the economy must have an influence on the stock market. And until last week's jitters, which we seem to be recovering from a little bit, at least, the stock market was riding high. Would it have been riding high if investors weren't believing that the economy was strong and perhaps getting better and we would avoid a recession?
No, that's pretty much the bet. And we've seen markets rising in part because companies like Apple and Meta are so heavily, make up so much of the overall index of like the S&P 500. So that has been one argument. But we have seen a strong economy. We haven't seen the Fed have to cut interest rates from a position of defense. And that's been one of the kind of pessimistic views for selling stocks or being worried. We saw a number of kind of underlying factors that have caused some of the gyrations that we've seen in the last few weeks that are partly technical and partly just driven by economic data. But broadly speaking, the reason the stock market is 5% from an all-time high and up 12% this year is because underlying investors are feeling optimistic about the path forward for businesses and the state of the U.S. economy.
So, Mary, if Joe Biden is being blamed by some ordinary Americans for their difficult economic circumstances, and I don't want to minimize anybody's personal situation because they are living through what they're living through, how is that impacting Vice President Harris? What can she talk about when it comes to money and the economy on the campaign trail?
Yeah, I think it's a classic sort of conundrum for a sitting vice president. How closely do you align yourself with the president that you serve under versus how much do you sort of market yourself as your own person, she frankly has not spoken much about the economy since taking over the ticket. She told reporters over the weekend that she will be rolling out her economic plan this week. So I think we'll have a better idea in a few days of what her messaging is going to be. I think Democrats were certainly hoping to be able to campaign on student loan forgiveness. Obviously, that is significantly tied up in the courts right now, so not necessarily something they can speak to as much as they hoped. I think low unemployment, wage increases, things like that. I think, pushing the idea that she could get a minimum wage increase if she had a Democratic Congress to work with will certainly be a messaging point. Just looking into my crystal ball. But yeah, I think we'll have a better idea in a few days once she rolls out her economic plan, exactly what her messaging is going to be and how closely she's going to tie herself to the quote unquote Biden economy.
And we do tend to focus on the top of the ticket in these presidential election years. And in the off years, generally the party in the White House loses seats in the Congress. Isn't that part of the problem? I mean, if you elect a presidential candidate, I don't care whether you're voting for Donald Trump or you're voting for Kamala Harris, if you elect them, you have to give them a Congress with which they agree and which who agrees with them in order to get the policies that you voted for implemented. Is there a disconnect in the electorate? Do we not understand this?
I think in the context of this election specifically, I think there are definitely voters who have very strong feelings about the individual candidates at the top of the ticket who do not necessarily align with their political party. For example, we have a lot of moderate Republicans in Charlotte who might not like Donald Trump, who might not vote in the presidential slot, or might actually vote for Kamala Harris, but who would then vote for a Republican candidate for a Council of State office or for a congressional office or a state Senate district. I think that's a real possibility, especially in an election like this, where you have someone like Donald Trump at the top of the ticket who is frankly, very polarizing to a lot of voters who would tr more traditionally align themselves with his party.
But I mean, if you want to, if you want Donald Trump's policies to be implemented, you want to have a Republican Congress. If you want Vice President Harris's policies to be implemented, you want a democratically controlled Congress. And you would probably like them further down the ticket in either party. And I'm just wondering if we understand that when we split the ticket, when we say, oh, you know, I don't want to give them too much power, that we're leading to this kind of obstruction and do-nothingness that we've seen in recent Congresses.
Yeah, I think you're making a good point. I think that disconnect is real. I don't necessarily know what the solution is. I think, frankly, in this country, we have sort of an emotional romanticism of being an independent, being someone who is willing to, not just vote straight ticket. I think that has an effect. But yeah, I don't know exactly what the solution is, but I think the phenomenon you're talking about is real.
So going back to who gets the credit, who gets the blame, Vikram, voters are blaming President Biden because they see what he's put them through as a regression in their personal economies. It was a busy week and on Sunday morning television this weekend and on CBS Sunday Morning, Joe Biden was there and he pointed to some of the projects that are going up around the country that people are just now beginning to recognize. This is all part of his infrastructure bill where bridges are going up and roads are being built. And he said the only mistake his administration made was not putting up signs that said Joe did it. He may have a point. Are those projects having an impact on the economy, though, as they go up in various areas around the country?
Well, as I understand it, those projects are supposed to have an economy over the long run. So it's not a big surprise that you don't see all of that. I mean, it's a very, very large amount of money, and you can't spend that money all at one go. It is going to be spread out over a long period of time. It happens. America is a big country. It happens in different parts of the country in, small bits. And so I think, the aggregate impact of it is probably not as much the perception of it is not as strong, and that is not very surprising.
And part of it, I think, is messaging, whether the message is being properly articulated or whether it's simply not being believed because it's not being experienced by voters. So, Mary, one of the things that Kamala Harris has been able to do, at least among party members in the Democratic Party, is to reinvigorate the party and reinvigorate the campaign. And they consider her to be a good deliverer of the Democratic message, of the Biden-Harris administration message. Is that proving to be the case on the stump, or is she just talking to the choir?
So far, I think she has been able to keep the positive momentum going. That being said, it's been, what, 3 weeks? And we've got about 90 days to go till the election. A lot can happen between now and then. As I mentioned, she is expected to roll out her economic plan this week. We'll see how that plays. She's got the Democratic convention coming up in Chicago. That's another opportunity for her to really define herself as a candidate, including her message on the economy. So in a lot of ways, it really remains to be seen. There is some polling. There was some polling over the weekend that appeared to show her picking up some ground here in North Carolina. There was a poll in the Financial Times released this weekend that appeared to show her picking up some ground, at least compared to President Biden, on the question of whether Democrats can handle the economy and whether voters trust Democrats with the economy. But, you know, we just don't frankly have a lot of information yet from reliable polling groups to indicate whether this is really, you know, just sort of an initial flash in the pan or something she can sustain through November.
And the Biden administration, Bailey, has put a lot of emphasis on the infrastructure achievements that they were able to push through Congress and which are now beginning to be built in places across the country. The government does not build bridges and roads and sewer and water system. That money goes to private and publicly held companies who then reap the benefits of the government money being pumped into those projects. So how does that affect markets? How do average people begin to feel those investments, or do they?
They typically don't. And the only reason I will say that is, for the most part, these contracts are announced so far in advance that that really gets baked into the stock price. So for instance, if the government strikes a deal with Lockheed Martin for something in the defense space, that'll very quickly play out in the market and it'll be more of a marginal benefit. We did see, though, with the initial kind of push from the Biden administration with this kind of infrastructure investment, investors were trying to reposition their portfolios to benefit to companies that maybe operate in the concrete space or have exposure through the raw materials that play into this. But those investments have really taken place when they were first announced, when they first kind of get passed through different parts of the government, and then it quickly kind of plays out. It doesn't necessarily, again, in an environment where your average American is likely investing in the S&P 500, it's a very marginal impact, if any, on kind of stock performance.
And yet the stock market has been doing relatively well this year. And although not everybody is invested in the market, many people are going to depend on their portfolios in retirement, particularly IRAs and 401ks, and they rise and fall according to the investment that you have in the market. So when we come back, I want to talk about the stock market, how healthy it is today as compared to yesteryear, where you see it going, and what impact that has on people's perceptions of the economy. We'll do that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the intersection of the election and the economy, what it all means. Vikram Kumar is here. He's a professor of economics at Davidson College. Bailey Lipschultz is senior reporter with the U.S. equities team at Bloomberg News. And Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Bailey, would I be right in saying that the health of the stock market, as measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average or Standard & Poor's or whatever, by normal measures, that the health of the stock market would indicate that it's in good shape? And if I'm right about that, is it in better shape than it was prior to the pandemic?
If you're strictly looking at stock performance and where valuations are and how it's performed, we are higher than we were back in 2020 in the wake of that kind of initial crash in March. In April, in the subsequent recovery, we're 5% from all-time highs, and we're, again, up 12% on the S&P 500 year-to-date.
And yet, last week, or in the last week or so, the market has been roiled. You wrote an article in Bloomberg headlined, $6.4 trillion stock wipeout has traders fearing great unwind is just starting. Now, I know reporters don't write the headlines, but that was last Monday. Market conditions improved as the week went on. So what's the answer to the question? Is the great unwind beginning?
We think it no one knows what's going to happen in the future. And I think one of the things the story got to in the third or fourth paragraph was really the sense that we've seen the market pull back, and we've seen large technology corporations under, from their stock perspective, under pressure for a number of weeks, a number of questions around whether this AI revolution is actually going to bolster their bottom line. What happened last Monday had a number of factors, from economic data, general fatigue around buying big tech stocks, but also something called the yen carry trade. Way too long to explain, but basically you borrow money where it's cheap, you invest it where it has better returns, and you make money. That actually kind of had a fallout last Monday. So that's why you saw a number of kind of doomsday headlines or kind of market talk, whether with Bloomberg Television, CNBC, or pretty much anywhere on social media. We saw the market actually, for the most part, recoup. Monday's losses were still lower than we were back in July, and we are still seeing the likes of an NVIDIA, one of the biggest companies in the world, still down more than 15% from its recent peak. So people who bought those stocks are feeling a bit of pain, but the uncertainty still kind of is there of what the coming weeks and months could bring.
So on Sunday, Brian Moynihan from Bank of America said, no recession. You can't have a depression unless you have a recession. And Donald Trump has been saying the new Great Depression is coming. Is all of that typical Trump hyperbole for which he is known, or is he right? Are markets due for a major correction or even a crash, do you think, Bailey?
Depending on what index you look at, we actually have seen a correction, a technical correction for the NASDAQ 100, which is made up of 100 technology companies. But if you look at, and maybe Vikram is probably better positioned to kind of dive into the underlying details, but from an economics perspective and from a markets perspective, we would have to see kind of a tremendous number of issues, job losses, and underlying inflation kind of spiking, and a broader market pullback to really cast us into a tailspin that truly would be defined technically as a recession, and therefore kind of a further correction for the stock market.
Mary, there are no more pension plans just to speak of. I mean, some people do have them, but not very many. And most people were encouraged 30, 40 years ago to start putting money in their IRAs. And something was created called the 401k, which was supposed to let you save for your own retirement. Some people have been more successful than others, and they are at risk in the stock market. So when the stock market wiggles and gyrates and goes up and down, that makes them very, very nervous. And we have witnessed enormous gyrations in the market in the last 20 years or so. But the downs always seem to be eclipsed by the upside. I remember in the Great Recession of a couple of years ago, I called my broker and said, what do we just sit here and wait for it to go to zero? What are we going to do? And now it's by tens of multiples higher than it was prior to the Great Recession. So it's difficult to take the long view, particularly the closer you get to retirement. What are people saying in Charlotte as you go around, or in North Carolina as you go around, and they see these gyrations in the market, or they see the fact that the market's been pretty high? Are they happy?
Yeah, I think, you know, the things that happened last week, I don't necessarily know how on the radar that was of the average voter, right? This sort of one day dip and then spiking back up. I think if it were to become more of a sustained thing, these big drifts or just a big drop that holds, that we don't bounce back from, I think that's really when you'll start to see the average voter paying more attention, thinking about, well, what does this mean for my retirement plan? What does this mean for any investments that I do have? You know, I think when there are these sort of little things like this, it feels like a really big deal when you're covering it. I don't know necessarily how much it's on the radar of the average voter, but I think, you know, going, obviously, you know, thinking back to 2008, for example, as a presidential election, the stock market played a really big deal in that, because it wasn't just like a one day, 2 day, 3 day event. It was this sustained thing that everyone was talking about, everyone was thinking about, everyone was feeling the effects of. So if we end up in a situation like that between now and election day, I do think suddenly the stock market could become a much more significant issue in the election than I think it is today.
Vikram, this is really complex. It's nuanced. There's so many factors involved in how people's personal economies are doing. Yes, prices at the grocery store may be up, almost unaffordably up in some cases. But if you have investments in the stock market and you were wise in what you invested in, you've done okay over the last four years. does it balance itself out in people's minds? I know they're not experts at this, and they rely on, they probably don't go back 4 years and say, well, here's what my portfolio looked like then. If I subtract out all the money I put into it since then, I actually am doing better. I mean, people don't do that. But does it somehow balance itself out?
Well, if you have a good amount in retirement, then it possibly can feel that way. But I think that, you know, there are redistributive effects of inflation and the high interest rates. And, you know, particularly poorer households don't sock away stuff in their retirement accounts, but they do spend in the grocery store. And so I think that they feel the sting a lot more than people who do have, you know, greater, you know, stakes in the stock market through their retirement accounts or directly through their investments. So yes, but it, again, it depends on, you know, where you are positioned in the economy that you're going to respond to it.
Bailey.
No, to Vikram's point earlier, when he made the reference to lower income households feeling the pain more in the V-shaped recovery we saw in the stock market, a number of economists viewed that as more of a K-shaped recovery. So you have this divide between classes. So if you have the ability to have hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more than $1 million in your 401k or retirement nest egg, you're benefiting because you continue to put money in the market, it continued to outperform, and you're actually sitting better now than you were before. If you're on the bottom leg of that K-shaped recovery, to Vikram's point, inflation hurts more. You probably did not get a wage increase that mirrored or outpaced the rising cost at the grocery store or at the pump or buying or renting out a house. So those are, that's another thing that does not necessarily show up as heavily in the stock market, but is certainly a case that we keep an eye on from an economic standpoint.
But again, presidents don't all have control over whether it's going up or down in the stock market or whether the economy is experiencing inflation or not experiencing inflation. But our two parties are very different, Vikram, in terms of their economic policy outlook. Republicans, when they are in control, tend to focus on tax cuts for the rich on the promise of trickle-down economics, which I believe most economists say is, it doesn't work. That's the word I'm looking for. And Democrats generally look at social programs and things that help the low to middle classes. Macroeconomist Mark Tama at the University of Oregon says his research has shown him that government spending efforts like those the Biden administration engaged in to help the economy recover, quote, have a much longer impact on the economy than tax cuts for the wealthy. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, the research is, can support both ideas. Tax cuts to the extent that they're not, there is a general idea that very high taxes are not very good, and very low taxes are not enough to support a good government. And so the taxes have to be at some sort of sweet spot. If they're higher than that, then tax cuts are actually going to be helpful. And that's what the idea of the Laffer curve has been. And people can disagree on that because nobody quite knows the truth here. I think that one of the big differences between the two parties, other than the tax cut and, you know, social spending, is the emphasis of the Republican Party on less regulation in the markets. So there is that element of it as well, that the Democratic Party thinks that, you know, things need to be regulated more, either for, you know, environmental purposes or social justice reasons. That has, you know, there are trade-offs to regulation as well. So I'm not a politician and I'm not a political scientist, and maybe Mary has more to say about that.
Well, Bailey, we're in a worldwide economy. We know that we can't solve the climate problem unless everybody in the world gets on board and is rowing in the same direction. It's not going to happen. But it's not just that. I mean, the European Union has really begun to regulate tech companies, particularly social media companies like Google and Facebook, et cetera. to a much greater degree than America. We have virtually no regulations, and they have other regulations that regulate other industries more than we do. It's a worldwide economy. Is it having an impact on the American economy, what the European Union is doing? Is it having an impact on American companies, a negative impact?
Regulation, if you walk the corporate line and talk to companies, regulation will inherently impact the bottom line. So if you look at big tech regulation in Europe, in the European Union, to your point, that does impact sales. I don't know that it necessarily is driving the stock market, but when we certainly see, whether it's in the US or places like Europe or Asia, if there's a crackdown or a push one way or another in pretty much any industry, that does have an impact on how corporations operate, certainly does.
And Mary, this economy that we're living through is affecting different groups of people in different ways. The American electorate is not a monolith, and it really does depend in many ways on your age. Consumer Affairs, which is the Journal of Consumer Research, at least that's what they call themselves, says Gen Z faces a tough financial road and mediocre pay. Gen Z dollars have 86% less purchasing power than those from baby boomers when they were in their 20s, and Gen Zers are paying 57% more per gallon of gas than baby boomers did in their 20s. And these people are just starting out in their adult lives. So how might that impact their political outlook?
It has a great impact on their political outlook. You know, I myself, I'm like a millennial Gen Z cusper, I think it's called, right on the line between the two. So, you know, just talking to people I know, I mean, I think we sort of came of age, the 2008 financial crisis is one of our earliest political memories. What that meant for our families and what it meant for that election cycle. So I think that creates sort of a lingering sense of anxiety around the economy whenever talk of a recession does bubble up. It can be kind of an anxiety-inducing thing to hear for that generation. I think, you know, it gets into a lot of stuff we've talked about, whether it's the ability to buy a home, the affordability of everyday goods, the affordability of a college education, are really top of mind for that demographic. And I think, you know, if either candidate can really, in the context of this presidential election, sort of create a cohesive message that appeals to the economic concerns of that generation, that could be a vehicle for really turning out that very valuable vote.
So Vikram, at the same time Consumer Affairs is painting this dismal picture for Gen Zers, Vox says of that same group of people, the real winners of the Biden economy have been 24-year-old student debtors who lost their jobs during the pandemic and now work in hospitality. That's an industry in which wages have risen sharply. People who own a house because home values have increased to the detriment of renters, have savings in an S&P 500 index fund because the stock market has boomed, lease an electric vehicle because the green economy surged during Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, and hate fast food because fast food prices have risen. Those are the winners, and they're 24 years old. So where should that put Gen Zers politically, and do they feel good about the economy or bad? And who do they give blame or credit to for however they feel?
That's a hard one.
Yes.
I do think that Gen Zers have a more difficult scenario that they have to navigate than I think that younger people had in the last 40 years. I think that the undertow of the Great Recession, global financial crisis of 2008-2009 was very extended. And it was only in the last couple of years of the Trump administration that the economy was really beginning to, you know, get amped up. And then the COVID happened. And so I think that, you know, there have been both economic constraints and I think psychological impacts of these very, very sort of, you know, one-off events. And but I hope that they're strong enough to come out of it. Tomorrow can be very different. And, you know, they have a lot of agency and I still think that, the future can be bright.
So I have about 40 seconds left, Bailey. This is a consumer economy. The markets rise and fall on consumer behavior. Even though we have this pessimistic view of the economy and how it's affecting us, consumer confidence is up. People still think they're going out and buying stuff. So that means something, I would think, even if you're buying stuff that's more expensive than it was yesterday. How might that likely translate into their behavior in the voting booth? I have 10 seconds, 15 seconds.
I don't know. People are still spending money because they can. I'm not a political reporter, unfortunately.
Mary, I'll ask you the same question quickly.
I think it kind of just remains to be seen, frankly. I think a lot will depend on how the
Okay,
economy starts to
stay
turn out over.
tuned. Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, Bailey Lipschultz from Bloomberg News, and Vikram Kumar from Davidson.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.